Because of something like sleep, my dad wouldn't let that happen for me. So he thought, look, it's a little bit discomfort now for Fajr and Sehri a little bit later on. Sometimes God speaks to us in the exact same tone. You've been very comfortable for very long. You've been doing what you want to do, going and coming, spending and doing whatever you want. Sometimes it's okay for me to make things uncomfortable for you to see the bigger picture at hand. Yes, it's grim to see, you know, individuals who tested positive, to seeing our elders struggle to breathe on ventilators. But the overall, the repairing of the planet, the repairing of our thoughts, okay? The idea that now we understand the beauty of a community. How many of you miss JCC right now? How many of you miss opening your fast and having a cup of tea with your fellow community members? How many of you will miss that in the lights of Qadr? Right? And we take it for granted. These are the bright moments. This is the overall goal for moments of discomfort. The taking off of the blanket, staying at home and secluding, right? Waking you up from the comfort and the sleep of your ghaflat and your heedlessness, shaking you, jolting you, awakening you, opening up your eyes, saying, look around you, look what's happening, look what you're doing to this planet, look what you're doing to yourself. You're forgetting the blessings that I'm giving to you. So yes, if this is the language of God, let's listen to what He's saying. If that means a little bit of anxiety and stress, then that's okay. It's okay to be uncomfortable for something that is good for you. That sometimes the greatest people that we look up to, we admire, also felt stress and anxiety. Sometimes they also went through mental health issues. It's okay to say that. It's not blasphemous to assume or to say the Prophet of Allah had stress and anxiety. Up and down the Quran, khawf and huzn, fear and grief, fear and grief. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, accept our qaleel ibadat, inshallah. We ask you, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to accept our du'as, forgive our sins, allow us to benefit from this new month of Ramadan. And finally, Allah, we ask you to protect us from any bala or any virus of the body and the soul. Grant shifa for all those who are sick right now, be it our equals in humanity or our brothers in faith. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
يا حنان يا منان يا ذا الجود والإحسان ثبت قلبي على الإيمان نرجو عفوك والغفران
اللهم اجعلنا من عتقاء شهر رمضان
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on this Foresight Holy Month of Ramadan. So we were talking about how the Holy Prophet has said that the days of the Holy Month of Ramadan are the best days, its nights are the best of nights, its hours are the best of hours, and this is a month in which you have been invited by Allah. Another one of the things that the Holy Prophet also has taught us and has encouraged us and has emphasized is to ask for forgiveness in this holy month of Ramadan, a holy month in which forgiveness is so much more easier to attain. But at the same time, dear friends, that we are asking for forgiveness from Allah, we really need to make sure that we don't continue to commit sins in this holy month of Ramadan. And so, as far as this is concerned, we have this saying, this tradition from the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, where he tells us, the day of your fast should not like be any ordinary day. When you fast, all your senses, your eyes, your ears, your tongue, your hands, and your feet must also fast with you. And so, dear friends, we need to realize that while we are fasting, in the holy month of Ramadan, it's not just our stomach which is fasting from food and water, but matter of fact, a true fast, a complete fast, A perfect fast in the holy month of Ramadan includes all of our senses. Don't look at what must not be seen. Do not hear what must not be heard. Do not say what must not be said. And be careful of your hands and feet, for they too should fast with you. Very quickly, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, Imam Zainul Abidin, the fourth divinely appointed Imam, says, O Lord, bless Muhammad and his family, and inspire us to know this month's excellence, and to honor its dignity, and to abstain from whatever you have forbidden in it. O Allah, help us to observe its fast by restraining our limbs from disobeying you, and by employing our limbs in that which please you, so that we may not lend our ears to any vain speech, and we may not direct our eyes, hands, and feet towards anything forbidden, and that nothing fills our stomachs except that which you have made lawful, and our tongues may not utter anything except that which you have allowed in this holy month of Ramadan.
With hope in our eyes, we search through the skies, waiting for our old friend. With loved ones nearby and our spirits high, a blessed time we'll spend in both love and in fear to Allah we draw.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Ramadan is here, Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. Cause Ramadan is here, whoa, Ramadan is here.
Iran has a very long history from the very old times. Lubalawa technique, very special technique.
These two were made by one person. That is very interesting.
The South Iran around Persian Gulf is very important for searching the modern humans' route out of Africa.
The Persian Gulf.
Now we are in the site of the cave named Tangshkan or Seyd Hatun, and this is one of the largest caves in the Alexandrian area. The whole of the layers here belongs to the Middle Paleolithic period. It means about from the 80,000 years ago to the 40,000 years ago. And now this phase dates about the 70 or 80,000 years ago, depending on the lithic typology. And we discovered some structures, very interesting structures. For example, that this is a structure of the water supply.
This structure is nothing but the stones set around the small basin on the cave floor to prevent soil from being washed into the water and therefore have clean and clear water to drink.
So this is one of the oldest human structure of the water supply in the world. because it dates to the Middle Paleolithic period, 70 or 80,000 years ago. Now, we understand that they made some kind of a structure for water supply or for stone floor and so on. So the Middle Paleolithic people is much more advanced people than we expected before.
The first Australopithecus, Bovastus, had small brains and were able to stand and walk upright. Homo habilis, that appeared around 2 million years ago, had bigger brains and started to make tools. Homo erectus got the ability to make use of fire. Homo sapiens, Neanderthalensis, that were the closest relatives of modern human, appeared in Europe around 200,000 years ago, and we, Homo sapiens, as modern humans of today, appeared in Africa around 150,000 years ago. The last two species lived together for thousands of years, but Homo sapiens, Neanderthalensis, disappeared forever around 30,000 years ago.
The archaeologist thought there are two routes for out of Africa. One route is via Egypt, via Sinai, and another route via Arabian Peninsula to the Persian Gulf. For the out of Africa, for these two routes, the people used the different periods. For the southern route, the out of Africa what happened in the very dry periods because of the level of the sea level of the Red Sea and sea level of the Persian Gulf is very low.
Melting or expanding of Earth's glaciers has been a major factor affecting sea level changes. Every time Earth experienced an ice age, the sea level dramatically fell.
Touching the southern route, the South Iran around Persian Gulf is very important. And Alsanjan is, of course, located in the southern Iran. So this is the reason why we started our archaeological research in Alsanjan area.
Excavate an ancient archaeological site. Archaeologists first consider a part of the site, then they start to dig the ground layers in a very careful way. During excavation, the exact location of the discovered works and antiquities is recorded. Soil from the excavation is analyzed by archaeobotanists and archaeozoologists to find seeds, pollen, bones, and animal remains in order to precisely rebuild the environment of that era. The shape of the objects is also analyzed to find out the techniques used in making them.
From this excavation, we discovered a lot of mysterium coins like this. They are the very typical in the Middle Paleolithic period in the Zagros area. For example, this mysterium coin was made on Lubalova technique, very special technique of the Middle Paleolithic period.
It is very hard work. It was used for hunting animals like gazelle, deer, horse, anything. From layer 7, we found this core. It is called Rubarwa Blade Core. And last year, we surveyed the area around the cave, and we collected this core. And from experimentation point of view, these two were completely the same. So I think these two were made by one person. I think one person, maybe 70,000 years ago, walked between the cave site and open site. That is very interesting.
Iran has a very long history from the very old times. And all of these sites are very important for the human history.
Signs of early human are not just seen in the Persian Gulf region. The tools made by them are also found in the Persian Gulf islands, like Fesh, that were once connected to the mainland of Persia. Within thousands of years, humans learned new techniques for making more delicate and efficient tools for their expanded activities. The gradual warming of Earth's climate made the vegetation coverage denser, so much so that there was no more need for humans to constantly move in search for food. Consequently, first steps towards sedentism were taken. Sedentism caused populations to gradually increase, and this had a negative impact on food resources. In the process of domestication, humans succeeded in raising some animals unlike their primitive ancestors that were able to produce more milk and wool than their needs. After about 1,000 years of grain farming, our ancestors could find crops that had the capability of being kneaded.
After the domestication of plants and animals, and when man could produce his basic needs, he gradually began to exchange the excess products. This was the beginning of a phenomenon called trade. Later, during late Sedentism and early urbanization, human beings gradually started to choose their own field of specialization. Communications were developed, fixed routes emerged, and trade became global. One of the most important of those routes is today known as the Silk Road. There are two ways to realize the events in the distant past. One, to study the historical texts, and the other, findings from archaeological excavations. Some pieces of evidence found through archaeological excavations in the Persian Gulf region prove the existence of marine communications among various civilizations of the ancient world. The formation of Sassanid Empire happened in 224 AD when the Parthian king Ardavan V was defeated by Ardashir I. Always passionate about the development of art and architecture, the Sassanids, in their 400 years of rule, built many structures and cities, among them the port of Siraf. The conquest of Iran by Muslim Arabs and the eventual end of the Sassanid rule could not stop the increasing growth of Siraf. It remained one of the most important trade ports in the world for hundreds of years. Siraf had become so crowded that 3- and 4-story buildings were erected and corpses were buried in stone graves in the surrounding mountains. Goods reached the Siraf port by big merchant ships and were distributed in the region through a network of roads, bridges, and caravanserais, and finally exchanged in the marketplace. Some of those markets are still as active as they used to be. Pottery, silk, porcelain, spices, perfumes, and precious stones from India, and wood and ivory from Africa were part of the goods exchanged in those marketplaces. In return, Persian Gulf pearls, rose water, perfumes, garments, textiles, precious carpets, minerals, and even bitumen were exported from the ports of the Persian Gulf by skilled Iranian and non-Iranian traders to other parts of the world. In the past, the port of Galhad, in today's Oman, was also one of the other major ports of the Persian Sea. In those days, the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, and a significant part of the Indian Ocean were all called the Persian Sea. Rulers of Persia used to govern Galhad and other ports and islands in the sea. The Galhad port was mentioned in the travelogues of Marco Polo and other visiting travelers. Today, similar historical sites can be seen in some parts of East Africa. The structures and buildings and the coasts were made by immigrants from Iran. In the 10th century AD, a person named Ali bin Hassan, along with his family, moved from the city of Shiraz to Siraf and left the port with 7 ships to the east and northeastern parts of Africa, today known as Kenya and Tanzania, and established a new government there. The Shirazian people were originally Persian. Their distinctive characteristic? Interaction with other people and nations with great respect for their beliefs. The Persian king Cyrus the Great founded the Achaemenid Empire in the 6th century BC. He is well recognized for his achievements in human rights, politics, military strategy, as well as influence on both Eastern and Western civilizations. Signs of moral characteristics can be seen in the remains of the Achaemenid relics. The way Achaemenid soldiers treated the representatives of affiliated nations are clearly visible there. The Shirazian people treated native East Africans and other African civilizations with respect and succeeded in changing the areas under their rule into thriving business centers. This went on until certain events changed the situation in the world during that period. Another thriving port of ancient times was Harira, an ancient 8th century city located in what is now called Kish Island in Iran. In 976 AD, the port of Siraf was devastated by a massive earthquake. As the result, the port of Harira gradually became the main trade center in the Persian Sea. During this period, the Portuguese began to occupy islands and shores of the Persian Gulf. The Iranian Safavid government had become embroiled in a long conflict with the Ottoman Empire to prevent them from entering the Persian territory. The Portuguese took advantage of the opportunity and constructed their own fortresses in the region. Albuquerque believed that the island of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf was one of the world's three strategic locations. To him, having control over the island would result in the domination of global maritime trade. Thus, he built a strong fortress there. Since the Hormuz Island is geologically a salt dome lacking fresh water, Albuquerque built a supply fort to be able to store this vital liquid. He also stockpiled ammunition and necessary supplies for his troops there. Imam Quli Khan, the ruler of Fars province at the time of Shah Abbas Safavi, took his army to the coasts of the Persian Gulf. With the permission of Iran's government, the Dutch established many business offices in Persian Gulf ports. Later on, they gradually closed their offices and moved to Hark Island, where they started to build castles and deploy heavy weapons. Then Emir of Hark, Mir Mahna, saw the invasion. He began to fight for the liberation of his land. At the age of 18 and during the rule of his father over the region, Mir Mahna also took part in the liberation of Bahrain and defeat of the occupying Huala Arabs. But this time he took command of the battle himself. Today, there are some people of the Mir Mahna clan still living on the northern coasts of the Persian Gulf. Even now, they preserve their old traditions, such as the important role of the patriarch in addressing the problems and spiritual needs of family members. People living on the edge of the Persian Gulf were very welcoming toward the Dutch in the beginning. But experiencing their tyrannical behavior, they all joined Mir Mahna to free their lands. After 15 years of struggle, Mir Mahna and his followers succeeded in driving the Dutch out of the Persian Gulf and finally raised their waving tribal flag over the Hark Island.
ليلة القدر يا فضل بارنا خير من الدهر بالعفو تاتنا
يا ليلة القدر يا فضل بارنا.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the night of power, Laylatul Qadr. The most important thing of this month is the night of power, Laylatul Qadr. The night which is superior than 1,000 months, 1,000 months jihad, 1,000 months rain, and the worship in it is superior than 1,000 months of worship, as has been narrated in the traditions. Yes, the night of power is a very precious and distinguished night. In accordance with the Quranic interpretation, it is a very auspicious night. And as could be derived from the traditions in this night, the sustenance and age of servants, and the good and evil of their affairs are destined. The Holy Quran was descended in this night. Also, the angels are descended all over the earth. And when they pass through the gatherings of believers, send salutations and praises upon them, and consider their prayers until the dawn. This is a very special night, brothers and sisters. We sometimes feel and think that it is another ordinary night. No, this is where Allah opens up, and He promises to open up the doors of His mercy, those doors that He does not open up the rest of the year. Some of those doors are open a year long, but these special doors that He opens up on this night are particular and specific. So let's, inshallah, be prepared to benefit as much as we can from the night, the Laylatul Qadr.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the night of power, Laylatul Qadr. It has been narrated that during this night, the prayers of all are accepted, and the prayer of no one remains unanswered except the following. Number one, the one who has displeased and angered his parents and was declared disinherited or rebellious by them. Number two, the one who has cut off his relationship with his kith and kin. Number three, the one who possesses animosity and vengeance of a believer in his heart. Number four, the one who consumes alcoholic drinks. Brothers and sisters, we know all the believers out there are, inshallah, free of all these vices. But in case you have slipped, in case you have made a mistake, now is the time to rectify. Now is the time to make sure that you reverse this action of yours before you get into the prayers of Laylatul Qadr, the night of power, the night of Qadr. You want your du'as to be accepted, you have to reverse these ill doings. Inshallah, we all have to introspect, think, evaluate, and analyze where we stand, and any discrepancy, any deficiency that we have that would stop our prayers to reaching Allah, we need to reverse the effect of that. After the recital of invocations and supplications, one should also allocate some time for self-meditation and pondering. Of course, this should be done at a time when he is free from whatever disturbs his thoughts, like domination of sleep, overeating, and pain of hunger. These are the advices of some of our senior scholars and urafa. Let's follow it.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
But you know that, that I will be better.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
While the technologies required enabling high levels of automation are advancing rapidly, producing a vehicle that can complete a journey safely and legally without human input remains a big challenge. Three key barriers must be overcome before they can be safely introduced to the market. That is technology, regulations, and public acceptance. We're prepared for you an article written by Hossein Dia, a professor of future urban mobility at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, Australia. The piece is titled, Why Self-Driving Cars Are Still a Long Way Off. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Hossein Dia's article. The recent crash of a Tesla self-driving car in the United States, in which two people died, has reignited debate about the capabilities and safety of today's self-driving technologies. Tesla cars include an autopilot feature that monitors surrounding traffic and lane markings, and the company is currently rolling out a more advanced full self-driving system that promises automatic navigation, stopping at traffic lights, and more. Investigators say it appears nobody was in the driver's seat of the vehicle when it crashed. The Tesla chief executive, Elon Musk, has said no self-driving features were in use at the time. Nonetheless, the tragic incident has raised questions over self-driving technology. How safe is it? And how much attention does it require from drivers? Experts talk about six levels of autonomous vehicle technology, ranging from level zero, a traditional vehicle with no automation, to level 5, a vehicle that can independently do anything a human driver can. Most automated driving solutions available on the market today require human intervention. This puts them at level 1, driver assistance, such as keeping a car in a lane or managing its speed, or level 2, partial automation, such as steering and speed control. These capabilities are intended for use with a fully attentive driver prepared to take control of the vehicle at any moment. Level 3 vehicles have more autonomy and can make some decisions on their own, but the driver must still remain alert and take control of the system if the system is unable to drive the vehicle. In the past few years, several fatal crashes involving Level 2 and Level 3 vehicles have occurred. These crashes were largely attributed to human error and to mistaking these levels of automation for full self-driving capabilities. Vehicle manufacturers and regulators have been criticized for not doing enough to make these systems more resilient to misuse by inattentive drivers. For higher levels of automation, a human driver won't necessarily be involved in the driving task. The driver would in effect be replaced by artificial intelligence self-driving software. Level 4 is a self-driving vehicle that has a bounded scope of where and when it will drive. The best example of a Level 4 vehicle is Google's Waymo robo-taxi project. Other companies are also making significant progress in developing Level 4 vehicles, but these machines are not commercially available to the public as yet. Level 5 represents a truly autonomous vehicle that can go anywhere at any time, similar to what a human driver can do. However, the transition from Level 4 to Level 5 is orders of magnitude harder than transitions between other levels and may take years to achieve. While the technologies required to enable higher levels of automation are advancing rapidly, producing a vehicle that can complete a journey safely and legally without human input still remains a big challenge. Three key barriers must be overcome before they can be safely introduced to the market. These are technology, regulations, and public acceptance. The self-driving software is a key differentiating feature of highly automated vehicles. The software is based on machine learning algorithms and deep learning neural networks that include millions of virtual neurons that mimic the human brain. The neural networks do not include any explicit "if X happens, then do Y" programming. Rather, they're trained to recognize and classify objects using examples of millions of videos and images from real-world driving conditions. The more diverse and representative the data, the better they get at recognizing and responding to different situations. Training neural networks is something like holding a child's hand when crossing the road, and teaching her to learn through constant experience, replication, and patience. While these algorithms can detect and classify objects very accurately, they still can't mimic the intricate complexities of driving. Autonomous vehicles not only need to detect and recognize humans and other objects, but must also interact with, understand, and react to how these things behave. They also need to know what to do in unfamiliar situations. Without a large set of examples for all possible driving scenarios, the task of managing the unexpected will be relatively resistant to deep learning and training. Policymakers and regulators around the world are struggling to keep pace. Currently, the industry remains mostly self-regulating, particularly in determining whether the technology is safe enough for open roads. Regulators have largely failed to provide criteria for making such determinations. While it is necessary to test the performance of self-driving software under real-world conditions, this should only happen after comprehensive safety testing and evaluation. Regulators should come up with a set of standard tests and make companies benchmark their algorithms on standard data sets before their vehicles are allowed on open roads. A graduated approach to certification is needed, in which a self-driving system could first be evaluated in simulations, then in controlled real-world environments. Once the vehicles pass specific benchmark tests, the regulators can allow them on open roads. The public must be involved in decisions regarding self-driving vehicle deployment and adoption as well. There is a real risk of undermining public trust if self-driving technologies are not regulated to ensure public safety. A lack of trust will affect not only those who want to use the technology, but also those who share the road with them. Finally, this incident should serve as a catalyst to bring regulators and industry to establish a strong and robust safety culture to guide innovations in self-driving technologies. Without this, autonomous vehicles would go nowhere fast.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله والحمد لله.
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the Month of Allah. In this segment, we'll be talking about famous Quran reciters in the world of Islam. One of the reciters of the Quran who's Egyptian, and probably you haven't really heard his name before, is Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadhi. Even me, myself, I hadn't listened to his recitation before, but I listened to one of his recitations, and I really liked his recitation. This reciter, he was born in 1915 in the Sharqiya Governorate of Egypt. Okay, we could say something about Sharqiya Governorate. The style of recitation of different reciters of the Quran is sometimes relevant to the place they are born, the region where they were born and they live. Okay, the Sharqiya Governorate is an eastern governorate of Egypt. The reciters in this region recite the Quran similarly. Okay, for example, Sheikh Mahmoud Ismail Sharif was also born in Sharqiya Governorate. His recitation resembles Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadhi, which we're talking about right now. And Sheikh Muhammad Al-Laythi was also from the Sharqiya Governorate. Or even those who were not from Sharqiya Governorate, but were close to Sharqiya Governorate, meaning the eastern governorates of Egypt, such as the Qahliya Governorate, such as where reciters such as Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar, Sheikh Abdul Samad al-Zamati, and Sheikh Hamd al-Zamil were born and raised and lived there, you will see many similarities among these reciters, because they were in the eastern part of Egypt. Likewise, in the western part of Egypt, you will see the same similarities between reciters. For example, Mustafa Ismail was in Gharbiya Governorate, the western governorate of Egypt. And Ghalwash, Sheikh Raghab Mustafa Ghalwash, was also from the western governorate. Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan was also from the western governorate of Egypt. And these three reciters, they recite the Quran similarly. Their style of recitation is similar. Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadhi, who was born in 1915, this was at a time when great reciters emerged in Egypt, such as Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, Sheikh Minshawi Abdul Basit, and all the other great reciters. Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadhi used to recite the Quran along with these reciters in different ceremonies that were held in Egypt, in different parts of the country and in different mosques. For example, in Lady Zainab Mosque, Sayyida Zainab Mosque, sometimes reciters would go there and recite the Quran for different ceremonies. Or in Masjid al-Imam al-Hussein, Imam Hussein Mosque, they would go there and recite the Quran. Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadhi is a very good reciter. This great reciter passed away in the 1990s, and many great reciters recited the Quran in his funeral, such as Sheikh Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al, Sheikh Muhammad Al-Laythi, and other great reciters. Now, with this introduction, let's go ahead and listen to the recitation of Surah Al-Isra, verses 13 to 14, by Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadhi. Let's listen and enjoy this recitation.
And for every person, we have imposed his fate upon his neck, and we will produce for him on the day of resurrection a record which he will encounter spread open. It will be said, "Read your record. Sufficient is yourself against you this day as accountant."
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.